Hi, this is Circe Olson-Wessner, the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeros, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, Schooling with Uncle Sam. I'm speaking with Cindy Griffin, who is a professor emeritus with Colorado State University in the communications department, but she also teaches for Women's Studies Department. She is the founder of Griffin Heart Foundation, which is a nonprofit dedicated to promoting civility, and I am speaking with her on the phone, long distance because of the pandemic, and I would just like to welcome her to the conversation. So hi, Cindy.
Hi, Circe. Thank you so much for reaching out to me.
Well, I really am intrigued about your foundation and about your work, and so definitely our listeners would like to learn more about both of those things. But I wanted to say, first of all, that last week I spoke with Professor Deb Kohler at San Francisco State University about what kind of classes she teaches. She's a professor in Women's Studies Department, and I asked her why it's important to offer programs and classes in women's studies, and I wanted to know what kind of classes you taught and why did you create those particular courses and why is it important to study women's studies?
Absolutely. So I think it's really important to have women's studies programs and women's studies classes on our campuses, and I wish we had them in our high schools and even as early as our elementary schools, because women's studies really is a questioning discipline, and it opens up the conversation. It asks us to think about who we are and how we became who we are. Mm-hmm. And from my perspective, our discipline, which is communication, for us, it's how do we talk about who we are, and then how do we talk from the positions that we occupy. And so I think I came out of the womb a feminist. I've been an advocate of feminism pretty much all of my life, and I think it's critical because it asks us really important questions that open up conversation rather than close off conversation. When I arrived at Colorado State University, in my department, there were no women's studies classes. There were no classes that were focused on feminism or gender or identity, and so I really had this wonderful blank slate that and a department that said, yes, please develop the courses that you want to teach. And so I developed pretty much everything that I developed was centered in women's studies or a feminist approach to education and pedagogy. And I developed a number of different courses. Early on, I started teaching a feminist theory course, and in that class, we explored different kinds of feminisms and what they are. We looked at privilege and we looked at masculinity. We looked at what's now being called intersectionality, which is how do we address all of the different components of our identities, so not just talk about male and female, but talk about male and then race and then sexuality and then economic resources and then religion and culture. We bring all of those bits of ourselves into any communication exchange. Mm-hmm. So how do we get more articulate about that? I was able to develop courses in the Women's Studies program, and I taught for a number of years a wonderful course called Composing Our Lives. And the question, it was an interdisciplinary course, and the question that we asked in that course was, what does it mean to be a feminist in the academy, in our professional lives, in our daily lives, in our families? And so we explored a whole range of really fascinating questions from an interdisciplinary perspective in that class. I also was able to develop two really exciting courses. One, my favorite course, which really led to the development of the foundation, was a course in civility.
Oh.
And that course asked students to engage. Again, so like the foundation, the question was, how do we engage in really difficult conversations,
mm-hmm.
about which we probably are going to continue to disagree, but we need to continue to work together, or at least we want to turn down the animosity and the hatred that's so popular and common in our culture today. So how do we communicate with one another civilly over issues and perspectives that we might disagree with? And that was a really wonderful class to teach. I strategically chose material so that at some point in the semester, whatever the students were reading, it would piss them off. So it wasn't designed to be an easy course. I picked materials that I knew at some point I'd get some student riled up about the perspective. Mm-hmm. Because it's easy to be civil with people that you agree with, but it's very difficult to be civil with people that you disagree with. And so I really wanted that kind of tension in the class, mm-hmm. so that we could practice those skills of, I don't agree with this, and in fact, maybe it even goes against some of my foundational principles, but can I continue to communicate with you in a way that's civil?
Well, let me just interrupt, because now my mind is like going into like different directions. So what kind of readings? Do you have like particular books you had the kids read, or that you can...
I did.
Yeah,
like... I did. I had a combination of books and articles. Mm-hmm. And so just for example, one of the books that I started with was a book called On Civility, and it was written by a Yale law professor, Stephen Carter. Mm-hmm. And he makes the argument for civility in our culture. He makes a very lovely argument for that. But he grounds his argument in the idea that it is religion that teaches us civility, and only through religion can we come to civility. And so, of course, there were students that really resonated with. Mm-hmm. Of course, there were students that really did not resonate with. And so we could talk about that. What is Carter saying? How would you disagree with him? What logics would you present to support your position? And how do we do that in a way that's respectful and promotes a civil exchange rather than an antagonistic and a hostile exchange? Another book that I began to use in the class was a book of writings by women, incarcerated women. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What that allowed us to do is bring up the whole issue of incarceration, which brings up the whole issue of how do we treat people civilly, even if they have done something wrong? Mm-hmm. Can we? Should we? And it also brought up a lot of issues around economic disadvantage, around addictions. And it's surprising, but many, many, many of us have family members, whether they're close to us or more distant, that are somehow implicated in those three sort of moments: incarceration, addictions, mm-hmm. Economic challenges and resources, abuse, homelessness. So mm-hmm. that book allowed us to bring in to the conversation all kinds of really prickly issues that as a country and a culture and a nation, we have a really hard time talking about. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so we have to practice talking about that in ways that were productive mm-hmm. and respectful, but also perhaps that we always disagreed on lots of different topics. But it gave me and the students a chance to sort of practice, how do I communicate with you civilly when I don't agree with you? And it really was a brilliant class, and that class really does inform the focus of the foundation as well.
Well, you know,
how do we
go ahead?
You know, how do we have conversations as members of a community and a public over these really complex and these really difficult issues in a way that's productive?
It does. It sounds really fascinating, and so I have two things to say. It would be kind of nice to have a high school class on composing our lives, you know, like a mandatory.
Absolutely.
Because mm-hmm. high school kids, you know, they think about this, but sometimes they think about it in a vacuum, you know, and to see,
yes.
to have it kind of put out there so that they could really identify who they are and, you know, how to make it in
yes.
this world. And also like almost like an adulting 101 class, but with
absolutely,
but more with self-awareness. And then the other thing is our museum also is focusing on some of the negatives or some of the things that are part of our lives. And so our museum just did a big exhibit on addiction and recovery. And we have encouraged people who have memories that they want to share, stories they want to share, to write on any topic, the good, the bad, and everything in between in military
yeah.
life, because, you know, it happens. And if we hide the fact that this is going on or this is, you know, a situation, it's not going to get resolved. And, you know, it isn't healing for anyone to have to hide it.
That's right. That's right. We have to start talking, mm-hmm. not shouting and debating or arguing. We really do need to start talking and engaging one another, because you're right. Those moments and experiences and issues are out there, mm-hmm. and we think it's easier to pretend that they're not there. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, it's not making it easier or better for us when we pretend those things aren't there. Mm-hmm. It's like a wound that festers. And you and I spoke about this last week. People want to be heard, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. we need to listen. We don't. It doesn't mean we have to agree or like, but we need to listen, because one of our most fundamental needs, I believe, as members of a community, is to be heard. People right. want to be heard.
Well, and that brings me to my next kind of question. So in most colleges, I know I did, in order to graduate with a degree, I had to take a three credit class in communication. So I couldn't see why I needed to take this, because
exactly.
I'm an art major, who cares, you know, blah blah. But then so I picked speech, because it was, you know, the easiest one, I thought. And to be honest, I don't think it did much for me. I certainly had some fun with some of my speeches, but first of all, why do colleges require one communications class? But listening to you, I'm wondering if you feel, and maybe rightly so, that there should be a larger requirement, more classes, maybe more specific, more useful classes in communication for every discipline. So
right.
What do you think?
Well, that's my home discipline, so mm-hmm. the answer to the last mm-hmm. question is yes. I think we should have folks take more communication classes. I think communication's interesting because we do it all the time, and mm-hmm. so we assume that we're good at it. Mm-hmm. And like anything, it's something that you get better at if you study and understand the nuances and the complexities and how this exchange of messages works or doesn't work. So the public speaking classes are really kind of a great example. My discipline, the origins of my discipline is the study of great orators. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And like any discipline, we have a hard time letting go of our roots, right? We want to mm-hmm. keep those historical roots front and center. Mm-hmm. The reality of it is, our world has changed so dramatically that the study of oratory is an interesting thing, but it isn't the most important thing that we do anymore, right?
Right.
Communication
right.
has just exploded in the last maybe 30 years. The ways we can communicate and the numbers of people that we can reach. So do I think the public speaking class is important? Absolutely, because the focus of a public speaking class should be, how do I insert my voice into the public conversation?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What are the skills that I need to do that effectively? I do think that our public speaking classes need to be revamped quite a bit, mm-hmm. So that we open up the channels and the strategies. But I think that when you think you're really good at something that you do all the time, but you've never really focused on it, mm-hmm. I think that what we're missing there is that we all can hone our communication skills. And for me, those skills I want to encourage students to hone are, how do I put my voice into this conversation in a way that's informed and meaningful and respectful? And even just to go back for a minute to the civility class, one of the questions we asked constantly is there a place for incivility? And the answer was always, I don't know. I'm not ready to answer that question with a yes or no. Mm-hmm. So should we always only be civil? I don't know. Could we learn how to be more civil in difficult exchanges? Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's where I think the beauty of a communication, core group of communication classes is really, really appropriate.
Yeah, and I guess now with you know, with more ways to communicate, you know, social media and things like that, you know, just learning how to specifically tailor a message to hit different platforms is important.
Absolutely.
But also, I did hear that, you know, doctors are very poor listeners and communicators.
That's right. That's right. And terrible communicators sometimes.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we found interesting as communication professors is that oftentimes our communication graduates would get the jobs that the marketing graduates were applying for because they were better communicators. And so that's a really interesting sort of moment to think about, that that what you need to be able to do is communicate effectively. And then can you learn some other skills in your job? Absolutely. But but our kids did really well with public relations and with marketing and with jobs where you're going to interface with a lot of different people in a lot of different contexts.
Well, I'm going to shift gears a little, and you've started to, you know, go into it with the Griffin Hart Foundation, but the goal of your foundation is to promote these civil conversations about issues that divide people. And you had already mentioned that fairness and equity and respect and identity, to name a few things. And so I think you answered it. Your work, both as a professor teaching communications and as a women's study professor, influenced your choice of causes. But can you go in a little bit further about why you chose civility for Griffin Hart Foundation and not something else?
Yeah, definitely. So when my husband and I were starting out our lives together, like a lot of people, you know, we didn't have very much money and we were building a building our life. And we used to talk a lot about, gosh, you know, when we have a little bit of extra money, it would be awesome to share that, that we don't need to make a lot of money just for ourselves. Wouldn't it be fun to get to a place where we had enough money that we could share that with other people? And so we had always done the small donations to the safe houses and to the food bank and to the to shelters for animals, etc. But we finally got to a place where we said, oh my gosh, look at this. We have a bit of extra money. Now's the time. And because of my work as a feminist and a women's studies scholar, and because of my commitment to understanding across differences, a foundation grounded in civility and civil conversations just really made sense to us. It just really captures, I think, the heart of who I am as a professor. And I could really see that there is a big need for this, that we need to be supporting entities like the Museum of American Military Family that are doing this really difficult, challenging work and doing it in really productive and really respectful ways. And so that's why the our foundation and your museum are such a great match, is that this is a prickly topic. It's a really important topic. How do we get the word out and how do we engage communities in conversation? And so it really is sort of a natural extension of who my husband and I are, and it just happened to be able to come into being because we'd worked really, really hard and had been sort of careful financially, and we said, look where we are now, we can share. And so that's what's that's really kind of the motivating story behind the foundation.
So I was wondering, and this is just me being, you know, out there in left field, your husband's a Vietnam veteran, right?
Not Vietnam. No, he is a veteran. He served 4 years in the Air Force during the Carter administration. And he also, he's a lifetime firefighter, so he just retired as a paid firefighter and continues to volunteer. So he's kind of also always had that give to the community perspective in his...
Yeah, so I was thinking that his military and now his firefighting experience, he has seen people at their very worst and and also their very best. And I was wondering if his military and, you know, his other experiences influenced why he wanted to start a foundation that looks at social justice and civility. 'Cause one doesn't really... usually equate the military with social justice, but then but it does when you think about what the missions are sometimes, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's about caring for and about others, right? It's it's one of the most civil things you can do, is to put yourself at risk for someone else. Carter would argue that in the book that I mentioned, that that is among our most civil. It's risking for the sake of community. It's risking to protect your community and to and to take care of members of your community. And so I think it's funny, he and I have never really talked about it. I suspect that that is, that you're correct, that that is an underlying motivation. Mm-hmm. And that, yes, he in the work that he's done, he has seen the worst and he's seen the best. Mm-hmm. And so I think it really speaks to who he is as a human being as well.
And I'm thinking the importance of clear messaging, you know, in crisis, you need clear messaging.
Absolutely. Yes, my husband, I don't know if it's all firefighters, but he's said to me, honey, it's never a good time to panic.
Yeah.
It's just never a good time to panic. And so, yes, and when you are involved in, you know, the fire service is it is modeled a lot after military sort of protocols and practices, mm-hmm. and the importance of clear communication cannot be overstated. Mm-hmm. You have got to be clear or things will go south really fast.
Right. Well, I agree with that. Because of my experience as a military spouse and you, of course, as a spouse of a firefighters, you know sometimes that when your husband, in this case, communicates, sometimes it is very clear and very succinct, and sometimes it's off-putting because they are directing you.
Because I'm not in the firehouse, right?
Yep,
I'm not your fellow, or I'm not your colleague. I'm your spouse.
Exactly,
that's true.
So our museum will be working with the Griffin Heart Foundation more in the future, as well as because of this grant. But I wanted to thank you very much for the grant that your organization gave us. It's very generous, and because of it, we're going to be able to develop a curriculum for our play Shout,
yes.
which is a play based on the experiences of LGBT service members and their families. And Laura Belden, who was our 2017-2019 artist in residence in the museum, and then a theater group in Richmond called Theater Lab, we collaborated together to create this play based in part on our anthology, also called Shout. And Melissa Rayford, who's in Richmond as well, wrote the play, and we debuted it last fall. And so it's a strong piece, and it deals with, you know, personal experiences, and both audience members who are both military or the LGBT community may not know much about the other people in the rooms, you know, backgrounds and experiences. And so we are very excited to get this grant so we can develop some curriculum. But I wanted to ask you, why did Griffin Heart Foundation choose to fund this project? Because I know you get so many grant applications from uh-huh. other people. What made you think that this was a good fit?
Well, there's several things that we get some amazing grant proposals, and it's really incredible to see the work that's being done across the country. This proposal really resonated with the reviewers and with myself for several reasons. One, it's talking about the military and military families is something that we don't do a lot publicly, right? Mm-hmm. So that there's a conversation that's not being had that your proposal brought to the surface. Mm-hmm. Our lesbian, gay, bisexual, queer members of the military, those are identities that have been erased and silenced, mm-hmm. and ridiculed and belittled, mm-hmm. and those are things that we can certainly do much better around, mm-hmm. in terms of communication. And so that piece really, really resonated with us. Also, that it's the sharing of the wealth, that this performance is something that is not just going to stay in one community, mm-hmm. that it's, you are really working to find ways to make this material accessible to lots of different communities, mm-hmm. in the ways that make sense to them. That really fits with the mission of the foundation. You know, there isn't one right way. There are many right ways to approach mm-hmm. the the issue or the problem. Mm-hmm. And then just finally, I think for us as a foundation, there are lots of grant proposals that lots of people would fund. Mm-hmm. This grant proposal felt like there's not a lot of entities that would fund it. So this is a way the Griffin Heart Foundation can really make a difference, is that this is a good match for us. Mm-hmm. And this is a proposal that is more challenging to get funding for.
Right.
And so it just, all the pieces just came together this year for us. And we're just really thrilled that we're able to provide the support. I think there's a final piece too. Mm. We do a lot with just a little bit of money, and your museum does a lot with just a little bit of money. And we love that idea that here's $1,000 and you can really run with it. You know, it's not $10,000 or $50,000. It's a small amount of money that has a pretty powerful impact.
Well, to us, you know, getting a grant is always exciting, because you are right. We do a lot with very little. And I think part of that's our military upbringing. You know, we live within our means because, it's one of our core values to be good stewards. So we are excited and we're thrilled and we're already thinking, you know, outside the box, and we're moving forward. Pandemic or not, we are moving forward.
That's right.
Life goes on. So I wanted to ask you, are there other projects that you personally or your foundation are working on that are exciting that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yes. Of course, the foundation, I'm continuing to think about how to shape it and mold it. And last week, you and I had some great conversations about how I might get some high school students involved. And so I'm always looking at the foundation in terms of how can I continue to grow this this baby that I love so much. Mm-hmm. I'm a diehard academic, so I'm a writer. Mm-hmm. Last couple of years has been interesting. I've had two book projects colliding at the same time, and so that's been a challenge to try to find the balance. But they're both just about done and almost out. One of them that I'm the sole author on is called Beyond Gender Binaries, an Intersectional Orientation to Communication and Identities. Mm-hmm. And that's with the University of California Press, and it'll probably be out in end of September. Mm-hmm. Really, really excited about that. That book really captures a lot of what you and I have talked about, that mm-hmm. we have to address all the pieces of our identities. We have to learn how to communicate in ways that are civil mm-hmm. if we're going to move forward as a civilization and as a collection of people, whether we're talking about families, local communities, states, etc.
Right.
The second project that is wrapping up right now is a book, a co-edited book with another scholar that I've written with over the last, 30 years now. She and I developed a theory of invitational rhetoric, and what we suggested is that rhetoric doesn't need, or communication doesn't need, to always be persuasive. I don't need to always try to change your mind. Mm-hmm. What communication can do is it can invite understanding. Mm-hmm. I can invite you to understand my different perspective, and you can invite me to understand your different perspective. And if I can set up the exchange in the right sorts of ways, and I can't always do it, but often I can come to know more about you and your perspective. Again, I don't have to agree with you necessarily, mm-hmm. but I can respect you for having that position and those experiences and that perspective. And so this edited volume is called Inviting Understanding, A Portrait of Invitational Rhetoric. And our theory was quite influential in our discipline. It raised a lot of excitement and controversy, and we're coming up on the 25th anniversary of that theory. So this book really commemorates that that theory.
Wow.
So those are the two projects that I'm wrapping up right now, and I'm really proud of them and kind of glad that they're wrapping up.
Yeah, no, I'm quite impressed with both topics. And this inviting understanding, I was thinking about kind of the book that's kind of been around forever, Getting to Yes, and not, you know, not positional bargaining, because you know, we're taught, or at least I am wired, because I think I know a lot. I know a lot about a lot of stuff, and I want my position, you know, I always want to convince people that I'm right. And you know, it's not always the best way to get things done, you know? You kind
That's
of,
right.
You know, we're egocentric as a
That's right.
culture. So,
yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
So those books will be academic books sold for colleges, or are they going to be for regular people, or?
Well, we're hoping the Beyond Gender Binary is designed for college classrooms, but I wrote it with an eye for the lay audience. So I'm really hoping that it will have some crossover appeal. I really did work very diligently to. These things need to be teachable, but mm-hmm. they also need to be really accessible. And so the writing of that book was really quite amazing, to try to, one, write from mm-hmm. an intersectional perspective, and then to make it accessible to people, because it's the topics are really challenging. Inviting Understanding, we also hope that will have crossover appeal. Initially, it's being marketed more to libraries. That publisher is Roman and Littlefield. And again, what Sonia and I did, my collaborator, Sonia mm-hmm. Foss from the University of Colorado at mm-hmm. Denver. Mm-hmm. And we really, both of us have a commitment to a much more accessible writing style. We think that clarity is important, and that writing to keep your audience confused and feeling like they're not very smart is not really a very civil thing to do.
No.
Good academics can write with clarity and interest, and so that book, we also hope. Some of the chapters in that book also deal with community organizing. Some of the chapters in that Inviting Understanding book are focused on pedagogy, so education, how do we teach. So there's some, both of the books I think are of interest to lots of different people, whether you're in an academic setting or not.
Well, they sound really interesting.
Thank you.
Are they going to be available to purchase on, are you going to have like a link on your website to where people can purchase if they want them, or will they just have to Google it later on and find them?
That's a really good question. With the presses that we're working with, I don't know if I can do that link.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly can put all the material that people would need on the foundation website, so that folks can then go just pretty much Amazon or go to the press,
Yeah. Speaking of your website, I was on it the other day and I noticed that you have internships for guest bloggers, and I just briefly glanced through the types of people. I mean, it's men and women and conversations and different writing styles. And I was wondering if you wanted to tell people who are, you know, bloggers or interested in this conversation, what are you looking for, and how does one get an internship and all of that?
Exactly. Basically, you send me an email and tell me what you're interested in blogging about. I will be very, very careful about who blogs for us, because the commitment to civility is critical.
Mm-hmm.
And so the foundation is not looking for bloggers that are going to say, let me tell you how it is,
mm-hmm.
and this perspective is the right perspective, because mm-hmm. that runs antithetical to what the foundation is about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for people who can engage these controversial issues from very civil perspectives, because we need to open up the conversations, not close them down. And so it's a particular approach to blogging, and so it can be someone who's interested in a particular issue, mm-hmm. or it can be someone who's interested in what's the issue of the moment. It's sort of a broad stroke to mm-hmm. blogging, but mm-hmm. probably the biggest criteria will be, can you engage these very prickly, controversial issues from a place of civility, from a place of respect, from a place that honors multiple kinds of identities and multiple kinds of positions. It's underutilized right now, and so this is something that would be very exciting to be able to develop for the foundation, to give us a bigger profile and to share what we're learning and what people know.
Well, I think it sounded really fascinating. I thought, what was it, 12 they have to do? It's like a 3-month thing and 12 blogs, or
so there was, exactly.
Yeah,
and we could set it up for what the blogger is interested in. So what's going on in their own life? What kind of time commitment and sort of, you know, writing schedule works for that person? Mm-hmm. So I really kind of do walk the civil talk. My goal is not to make people anxious and miserable.
Yeah.
It really is to ask people, where are you at now and where would you like to be and what works for you. So a 3-month stint, a 6 months, all of that is very negotiable.
Well, it sounds really fascinating. So we have a minute or two left, and I just wanted to throw it out there for you to talk about anything you wanted to about your foundation, about your classes, about anything you'd like for about a minute.
Sure, yeah, because this is an educational sort of focus, I think I will say that education is foundational to a civil society, and that we need to be thanking, or not we need to be, I'd like to put out a thank you to all the educators that are out there right now struggling and creatively, desperately figuring out, how do I move my face-to-face class to an online forum? How do I continue to teach in ways that are meaningful to me, but also meeting the needs of our students right now in this very, very challenging time? So I'm just going to give a big heartfelt thank you to the educators right now who are really working really hard to keep our schools open and our students moving forward.
Well, and I want to echo that. I taught school. I taught for 18 years. And 1 year I decided, well, I was just going to homeschool my kid. And that didn't work out well for either of us. Talk about uncivility, I'll tell you.
Yeah, so. And we're really challenging our teachers from at every level right now. We are really it's a big ask.
Yeah, because, you know, with IEPs, you know, these individual education plans, you've got kids on multiple different IEPs, and you're scrambling to try to help every kid succeed, and you don't have...
Yep.
And the parents at home don't have the resources to, you know, I find that during this pandemic and these times, exactly what you're talking about, I have seen so many great things coming together. This is what America is about, you know, and this is what the world, this is what the world's about, really, you know, people, scrambling to help somebody, people coming out of their way to make extraordinary things happen, impossible things happen.
Impossible, yes.
But they have to. Here...
Yeah, teachers had 1 week to get their classes online.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that's just absolutely... And they're doing it, and so thank you. Thank you for...
Yeah.
Being such good teachers.
Yeah, no. Well, I believe that education, teaching is a calling. It's not a profession. I mean, people certainly don't join teaching for the money.
No.
They do it because they want to make the world a better place through their students. And so, yes.
That's right.
So they're willing to do all of this, you know, because it's not about them, it's about, you know, the kids and
that's right.
Yeah. Well, so I think we have covered an awful lot, and this has been very interesting. And so I wanted to wrap this interview up and thank Cindy Griffin once again from the Griffin Heart Foundation. Oh, give us your website. You are
absolutely. It's www. And then it's both my last name and my husband's last name together. So Griffin, G-R-I-F-F-I-N, Griffin as in Frank. H-A-R-T-E, Griffin Heart, Foundation, so that's kind of long, so griffinheartfoundation.org.
Okay, so I wanted to thank you once again for talking to us. This has been our podcast, Schooling with Uncle Sam, and I've been speaking with Cindy Griffin, and she's talked to us about the Griffin Heart Foundation. There's a lot of fascinating, wonderful blogs on the website. There's information about grants for any of you who are interested in grants, and I wanted to thank you, Cindy, so much for this talk. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure, too. Thank you so much for inviting me.